I'm Taryn Ward.
And I'm Stephen Jones.
And this is Breaking the Feed, social media beyond the headlines.
We're taking a closer look at the core issues around social media, including the freedom of expression, or free speech as it's sometimes known, to better understand the role that social media plays in our everyday lives and society.
Last episode, we looked at the congressional hearing on anti-Semitism at Harvard, Penn, and MIT. This episode, we'll talk through seven cases and several hypothetical variations to better demonstrate similarities and differences between how the United States Supreme Court and the European Court of Human Rights address hate speech.
Let's talk through a few hypotheticals, and if you're wondering, this is part of the reason this episode, unlike most of our other episodes, is marked as having adult content. So if you have a young person in the room, or you would like to avoid offensive speech yourself, you might want to consider hitting pause and continuing another time, or you can skip ahead and know that the answer for virtually all of these hypotheticals is that it depends on the context.
Back to context. So all of these hypotheticals are based on real facts from real cases, and we'll provide the case names and details in the transcript on our website. Let's dive in. So the first case I have for you is from the United States, and just a little bit of background. So this involves a state statute that made it a crime to burn a cross with the intent to intimidate. Again, it's important that, you know, all those elements have to be present for it to be a crime, right? You have to be burning a cross with the intent to intimidate. So our fact pattern is as follows. There's a KKK rally, a Ku Klux Klan rally, and the defendant burned a cross and was then convicted of violating the relevant statute. So my question for you, Steve, is whether you think this person's right to free speech was violated.
Oh, this is tough. And given what you've said over the last couple of episodes on this issue, I'd have to guess that in the US, probably not. Although, in my view, they should have prosecuted him and put him away for a while. But that doesn't mean that they didn't violate his right to free speech. Go on, tell me the answer.
So this one is really interesting. So the outcome is slightly complicated because of how the votes split, and we're going to hear that a lot in these cases. But essentially the outcome was that the restriction was permissible only if it required proof that the act was done with the intent to intimidate. So basically the court found that the intent to intimidate was what saved the statute, but you had to show that. So then it becomes, a question of context. Can you show that this person did this act, burn this cross, with the intent to intimidate?
That's interesting, isn't it? Because I would have thought that anybody burning a cross at a KKK rally was doing it to intimidate. That was sort of the historical point that was being made, was it not? I mean, just turning up in the white robe and the white hood should probably be enough to be accused of being intimidating.
Well, so here's a related fact pattern to consider. So in this case, defendants burned a cross on an African-American neighbor's yard after a dispute. And they were also convicted under the relevant statute. So it's not funny. So just to be clear, we're not laughing that this happened to someone. We're laughing because really the absurdity of all of this and the difficulty in figuring out how to look at these fact patterns and to apply the law in a way that is even and fair, but also considers the context. And it's really hard because these fact patterns are all weird.
Yeah. I mean, I'm laughing because it's like, obviously, this should, by what we've said so far in this episode and the previous ones, this should be permissible to stop this person doing this. But I'm horribly afraid that, in fact, was not justified to stop them doing this. So you know, I don't know. This is why I'm laughing, because it just defies common sense sometimes.
Yes. And to be clear, you know, we are talking about the U.S. now. So there are other laws that were violated by, you know, going onto somebody else's property and burning a cross. And in a lot of cases, you can be shot for doing something like that. But the question was whether, you know, under this statute, they could be prosecuted. And, you know, I think it's a really interesting opinion if you're at all inclined to read one. This is one that's worth reading. How might this be handled in the EU? Steve, I think, you know, what you said is interesting because you came up through the UK system and now live in Canada, which is, you know, sort of somewhere in between. And we can only speculate, of course, because we haven't seen this case come up in front of the EU court. But you would see the court balance out the freedom of expression and the protection of other rights in public order. And I think probably this would come down to a matter of judgment for each member state to make for themselves. But if they did write this sort of regulation and this was the rule, I don't know that the court, the EU court, would strike it down or would be that upset or worried about it. I think it would be a lot easier, in other words, to have a statute like this pass and be okay in the EU than in the US. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, that's my feeling. There's all sorts of things that the German government won't let its citizens do related to, you know, Nazism and neo-Nazism. I think just this week they passed a law to prevent the neo-Nazis getting public money, which probably wouldn't fly in the US. And I would be surprised if the if that goes to the European court, that would be overturned, because there's some history there. And I think Europe is sort of very cognizant of the impact of history on its internal stability, and the US perhaps not so much. And, you know, it is really interesting. But I think in Europe and in the UK, this would be considered hate speech and not permissible as freedom of expression.
Yeah, I think that's right. Second case, this one is more recent. So this is actually a 2015 social media case. Here's the fact pattern. And again, this is, you know, not for children. Defendant and ex-wife had just had a contentious divorce. Right? Ugly, very ugly, not pleasant. Defendant starts posting some really concerning things on social media, and I think it's fair to call them concerning. His graphic posts on Facebook took aim at coworkers, law enforcement, but really his ex-wife was sort of at the center of this. Defendant was convicted and sentenced, but appealed to the Supreme Court. So, Steve, what do you think? Was this a violation of the defendant's right to free speech? You know, he was saying offensive things. He was saying some really nasty things about his ex-wife on social media. Do you think it's right that you can be prosecuted for what you say on social media?
I think that you should absolutely be prosecuted for some of the things that you say on social media. I have serious doubts that it was permissible in this case, because saying offensive things and even posting offensive images isn't necessarily a crime unless it's been, you know, specifically called out, right? So, I mean, revenge porn, for example, has become, you know, subject to legislation, but prior to that, it wasn't something that could be stopped very easily, if at all. So, you know, and if he wasn't making specific threats, you know, verifiably trying to harm these people under the US law, as I understood it from the explanations, I'd be surprised if this was okay.
Well, let's look at what the defendant actually posted. And one more warning, okay. this is not for children's ears. These are quotes. It's not me saying this. This is what the defendant actually posted. "There's one way to love you, but 1,000 ways to kill you. And I'm not going to rest until your body is a mess, soaked in blood and dying from all the little cuts. Hurry up and die, bitch." That's one. The second one worth considering is, "Revenge is a dish that is best served cold with a delicious side of psychological torture." The third, after she got a protective order, was, "Fold up your protective order and put it in your pocket. Is it thick enough to stop a bullet?" And then the next day, there was a post saying he was ready to make a name for himself. Quote, "With the most heinous elementary school shooting ever imagined," end quote. And then, quote, "Hell hath no fury like a crazy man in a kindergarten class. The only question is, which one?" Does that change your mind?
I mean, I think probably he committed some crimes there, but I'm still not sure that his right to free speech was infringed, given the way that the Constitution describes it in the US. Honestly, I don't know. Obviously, I think that should have been, you know, stopped. And he has all sorts of serious issues which probably need to be investigated, and possibly he needs to be either treated or put into some other kind of institution. But tell me, because I have no idea.
I know. It's always, you know, you read through the fact description in these cases, and you can sometimes sort of guess which direction it's going just by the way they've framed things. But then sometimes you are surprised by the direction it goes in. So I think I didn't repeat these things just to shock people, but I do think it's important that we all understand what the courts are grappling with and that they have to make these decisions. And, you know, they are saying, the saying is really that we have to protect speech even that offends us. And I think this is very offensive to anyone to read this. And it's, you know, if somebody wrote this about me, I would certainly perceive it as a threat. In this case, the reasoning is again, complex, because it came down to the state of mind required for a conviction. But in this case, the conviction was not upheld. So again, intent mattered. And we're going to see this a lot. I know this isn't a popular thing to say anymore, anything to do with intent. But at least in this context, no pun intended, it is the legal standard. It's intent matters a whole lot. And you see these inquiries happening. How would this play out in the EU? I think, again, you know, we already probably know it's going to be a balancing of protecting free expression on one hand and protecting individuals from intimidation and harassment on the other. And again, it's going to come down to a very close look at the details, but I think this case probably comes out differently. What do you think?
I would hope so, certainly. I mean, I would hope that this would not be permissible and that stopping it would be entirely within the right of the police and the Crown Prosecution Service in the UK and whatever jurisdiction that it would happen in. Yeah, that obviously is abhorrent behaviour, and either he's an absolutely dreadful human being or he's quite ill. And which of those it is needs to be sorted out. Fortunately, and I'll touch wood when I say this, we don't really have school shootings in the EU or in Canada. But for somebody to make that threat, I mean, it's better that people make the threat on social media so they can be stopped, I guess. But that's very disturbing that you can say those things and, you know, continue saying those things on social media or on any forum.
Yeah, I agree. Now, we can't talk about any of this without looking at Westboro Baptist Church. This is one that is, lest I be accused of being stuck on this, I am stuck on this. This is a horrible, horrible thing, horrible in a different way to what we're just talking about, but actually not so different. So if you're not familiar with the Westboro Baptist Church, this is widely considered to be a hate group, not just in the US, but in other countries too. And they're best known for their public protests with slogans like "God hates fags" and "Thank God for dead soldiers." It has been described as engaging in hate speech against everyone, from atheists to religious people, including other Christian denominations, especially Catholics, and has been widely condemned accordingly. Again, not just in the US. So the specific fact pattern we're looking at today was a case where Westboro members showed up at a funeral for a US Marine. He died during the Iraq War, and they showed up and stood near the funerals, so about 1,000 feet. I don't know how many meters that is. Not really that far away.
Not far.
But they were on public land, and they displayed placards in their custom, including, again, "Thank God for dead soldiers," and "God hates fags," and "You're going to hell." The Marine's father filed a lawsuit seeking damages under an intentional emotional distress claim and a few other related claims. And in a statement released after the charges were filed, Westboro members denounced the Marine's parents for raising him Catholic. So they really doubled down on this. There is no apology. There is no sort of, oh, maybe we made a mistake. It was, well, they had this coming. Initially, a jury awarded the Marine's family something like $10 million. Right. So, you know, this case makes its way up the chain and finally to the Supreme Court. So what do you think, Steve? Were the statements made by Westboro protected speech?
Dear God, I hope not. I mean, seriously, like, you know, the Westboro Baptist Church, for those people who don't know, forms the core the core of the idea of the church, that in the movie The Kingsman, the entire congregation executes itself with the help of one of the Kingsmen. And you're not supposed to care because they're that vile that you just don't care that they all kill one another. It is a truly objectionable group, and this is a truly objectionable thing to do. I mean, what is wrong with people that they would do this? So, God, I hope. But I have this horrible sense that it was, in fact, protected speech.
Yeah, I have some bad news for you. So the Supreme Court issued an 8-1 decision in favor of Westboro. So, again, context mattered. Roberts noted that the memorial service was not disturbed directly as the protests finished before the memorial service had actually started, and also noted that Westboro had notified authorities of their intent to do this and complied with police instructions. And these things seem to matter in the opinion. A few interesting facts about Westboro. Fred Phelps, who founded the organization, handles their lawsuits through their family law firm. So 11 of his children are lawyers, and they handle all of these claims. And that sort of makes sense because I don't know anyone who would really want to take this on directly. Although I do know people who work for groups who sometimes agree with them or support them, not in what they do, but from a free speech standpoint. And members of this group have been banned from entering Canada and the UK. But Westboro is still apparently in operation. How might this happen in the EU? Steve, do you want to take a crack at this?
I think if they tried to do that in the UK, they'd probably need protection from the public, from the police, for a start. I mean, this would not go well. Protesting a dead Marine would not be an approach that would garner any kind of sympathy from the public. I just can't believe that you would get away with this. I mean, it's possible you could, but I would hope that you would not. This would not be okay.
The point you raised there is really interesting and important, and it's going to come up in our next fact pattern because it is surprising, given that this was a Marine, that there was no counter protest and that happened later. To be fair, but you're absolutely right. Part of this is about stopping it before it starts, which is something the U.S. law really disfavors. Not that you can never do it, but there is a real hesitation about stopping speech before it starts because you want to give people at least a chance or an opportunity to hash these things out and to speak.
And if there was going to be a conversation, I genuinely believe that the best way to solve conflicts and difficulties is to have a conversation, and as far as possible, speech should be allowed. But if you're going to just say offensive things at the funeral of, for example, a Royal Marine, then there will be other Royal Marines there, and they will take a dim view of you doing this, and things could get a little unpleasant because they have a certain amount of feeling for their fallen comrade. And I'm damn sure the same is true of US Marines. In fact, any branch of the US service. So it's just a terrible thing to be able to do because I don't see the conversation there. I don't see how this speech is in any way moving forward any agenda other than just being completely objectionable.
No, I agree with that. I think, so going back to what I said earlier, I think probably when we think about how this would be handled in the EU, I think it's unlikely to come up to begin with. Because I don't see anyone giving a permit for this to happen in the first place. So I don't see the UK saying, hey, yeah, great, go ahead, here's your permit. Go stand in this park right next to a memorial service that's about to start and go ahead and say these things. But let's say that it does. Let's say somehow they get this permit and it goes ahead. Although an intentional infliction of emotional distress claim may not be permitted, I still think there are ways of punishing this kind of behavior.
I would sincerely and deeply hope so, yes. But it is, of course, a very fine line because the legitimate protests, which might be annoying to people, you know, for example, Let's Stop Oil, annoyed a great many people. But legislation to ban those protests, annoyed an equal, if not greater, number of people, quite justifiably, in my view, you know, because that's a legitimate protest trying to make a point. I think that's the context, once again, definitely matters. But let's hope it never comes up in the UK. It would be a bad day.
Yeah. Well, and I think the difference, you know, between the two protests you just described there is whether it's targeted at an individual. And I think in this case, it's hard to argue that it wasn't. They didn't hold, you know, to my knowledge, they didn't hold signs or posters with his name on it, but it was directed at dead soldiers. And that's a pretty specific thing given what was happening right next door. And that feels, you know, that feels like a personal attack rather than I'm trying to say something about the world or something about my viewpoint. But you're absolutely right. It is hard. And finding that balance is, you know, every court, every country has to sort of grapple with that. So I have one more U.S. fact pattern for us, and then we'll turn to some from the EU. Bit of background.
Okay.
Yeah, I know. This neo-Nazi group announced their intent to hold a demonstration in a large suburb. So this suburb in particular has a substantial Jewish population. It still does now, actually. And at the time, it included many Holocaust survivors. And this demonstration that they asked permission to do would consist of 30 to 50 people marching single file in front of the town hall. Demonstrators involved would wear uniforms similar to those traditionally worn by Nazis, including the swastika armband. There were a number of local Jewish groups who objected to this, obviously, and they planned a counter demonstration and expected more than 12,000 people. So this is sort of to your point about, you know, somebody saying something offensive, how are people going to react? So this was sort of the pushback. So you have 30 to 50 people who want to march around as Nazis. You have another group of, you know, more than 12,000 who want to come out and say, no, we don't accept this. The village in this case sought an injunction because they didn't want, they just said, no, thank you. We don't want any of this happening. Please, can we prevent this group from marching or displaying symbols that could incite violence or cause emotional distress? And they framed this really as a public safety concern. And they, you know, they looked at the numbers and looked at how all this was likely to play out. And they said, you know, this is not great. So my question for you in this case, Steve, is would preventing the demonstration violate the neo-Nazi group's free speech rights?
Oh, God, unfortunately, I think it probably does. And I'm horrified to say it.
We actually don't know because the procedural background in this case is complicated, as it so often is. But in this case, the group agreed to change the time and location of the demonstration before the Supreme Court reached a final decision, which I think there are a number of reasons this might have happened. But I think maybe some of it was concern that it wasn't going to go their way. And I think that sort of opens the door to thinking about, you know, this public safety question and at what point towns and cities can step in and say, you know, this is really too much for us to handle. And that may move things one direction or other. How about in the EU, Steve? How would you think this might shake out?
Well, I mean, in Germany, it would be a non-starter, right? That whole idea of marching with Nazi paraphernalia would be forbidden from the get-go, and rightly so. Now, you know, there are neo-Nazi organizations across all of Europe, and they do protest, sadly, because some people don't learn from history. They get addicted to the bad parts of it. So, yeah, I think it would depend entirely on where in the EU it happened. Germany, definitely not. In the UK, maybe it would be okay. France, maybe. Italy. Mm-hmm. Essentially, they're part of the ruling coalition now, aren't they? So probably okay.
Yeah. So I think the important thing is the EU is really different to the US. I mean, similar in some ways too, but the EU is different because each member state can largely come up with their own rules. And it only makes it to the High Court if there's a question about whether these rules conflict with, you know, the core values. And so I think you're right. I think Germany sort of leads the way in one clear direction on these issues. And as long as their way of handling it is okay, it's probably fine for for the other jurisdictions to do the same thing, even though Germany has, is uniquely situated. Before we move on to look at some EU cases, I just want to say this is not the court saying they support any of this speech. The court is not saying, yes, it's great to threaten ex-wives or to talk about shooting up schools or to say horrible things in a memorial for a fallen soldier or that Nazi protests or neo-Nazi protests are a positive thing. It's them trying to figure out, trying to balance out and to find the line between, protecting free speech on the one hand and other factors on the other. So although when we talk about the EU court, we're always talking about them doing this balancing, the US Supreme Court doesn't necessarily talk about things in the same way, but they're doing some of the same things. And this goes back to what we said in an earlier episode about how the approaches are different, but they really are similar in some important ways.
Yeah, yeah, no, I think that is really important. And of course, they don't support these viewpoints. It would be, horrifying to think that you had Supreme Court justices who did. And part of the difficulty with free speech is, defending your right to say it, even if I think it is absolutely terrible. I think there are important exceptions and threatening people. It probably should be a very important exception to that. And I guess it just depends where that line is drawn, right? And that was what those cases clearly demonstrated. And it's not clear in that last example whether that protest was cancelled really because of the neo-Nazis or to protect the neo-Nazis from the 12,000 counter-protesters who were turning up. So that's a bit ironic, isn't it? Mm. All right, let's see how these things go in the EU.
Let's. I actually have a UK-based case to start us out. So in this case, applicant was a member of the British National Party, and he displayed a large poster in the window of his first floor flat depicting the Twin Towers in flames. So you have the Twin Towers in flames in the background and the words, "Islam out of Britain, protect the British people," and then a symbol of a crescent and star in a prohibition sign. So the police showed up and they removed the poster after a member of the public complained, and the applicant was invited to an interview. They're unfailingly polite in this country. He was invited to come down and have a chat with the police. And when the applicant refused to attend, he was charged with an aggravated offense, which was displaying a message with hostility towards a racial or religious group. This case eventually, because applicant appealed, so the European Court of Human Rights heard this case. So, Steve, was the applicant's right to free speech violated?
I mean, who didn't he offend there? I mean, you've got displaying the Twin Towers in flames, obviously offensive to everybody in the United States, if not every right-thinking person in the world. And then the attacks on Islam. But he didn't actually threaten anyone, did he? Out of Britain is, obviously objectionable. Oh, I'm not sure. I think possibly they were infringed even in Europe.
Okay, that's interesting. So let's change the words. So you have Twin Towers in flames in the background. You have, the crescent and star with an X through it. But instead of Islam out of Britain, protect the British people, let's say it's more direct. It's more something like Muslims are murderers or something really targeted, a more targeted accusation. Does that change your analysis at all?
It's a marginal call, right? Because he is saying hateful things about a racial group. So that is definitely hate speech. Yeah, I think the more direct, the more obvious it is, perhaps the more likely it is to rise to the level of hate speech rather than just freedom of expression, because again, the context becomes clearer. He's not just objecting to the influence of Islam. He's blaming Muslims for terrorist acts, basically saying that Muslims are terrorists and they need to be disposed of. That starts to get a little bit nastier.
Yeah. Okay, so let's say we keep the poster as it was, but this man happens to be in a dispute with his neighbor. they just hate each other. Like, long ongoing thing. And his neighbor happens to be Muslim. And he puts this not in a window facing the street, but a window that faces the neighbor directly. So, you know, every day he goes to his coffee, his kitchen to have a cup of coffee. And the first thing he sees is this horrible poster. Is that enough, do you think?
Oh, well, I mean, the honest answer is I don't know. I would hope so, because, you know, you're actually being hateful towards a specific individual and making their life miserable. And I don't think that you should be allowed to do that. And I would hope British law and European law would prevent you from doing that. But you're sneaky and you pick difficult cases, so I'm not sure.
No, this really is about your opinion, because you're right. It is a judgment call. You know, the courts are doing the same thing we're doing right now. They're looking at all of the facts and then they're looking to apply the law. But the law isn't written in a way that gives you a cut and dry answer for every single scenario that comes before you. You have to look at everything. You have to consider all of the possible scenarios, all of the ways this could vary in the future, and then make a decision. So it is really tricky. So in this case, with the facts as I originally presented them, the European Court of Human Rights said the right to free expression was not violated. So they said that this was an attack. Yeah, they said this is an attack against a religious group. And in this case, implying that the group as a whole was guilty of a grave act of terrorism was incompatible with the values proclaimed and guaranteed by the convention. So tolerance, social peace, non-discrimination, this went too far, and the UK police were well within their rights to remove it. How might this be handled in the US? I think, you know, if you've been listening at all to the previous hypotheticals, I think it's very likely this shakes out differently in the US. And, you know, police removing speech like this from private property, I'm struggling. I never want to say for sure because I haven't seen this case. To my knowledge, there's no case law that says, but I'm struggling in my mind to think of a scenario where the United States Supreme Court says, oh yeah, that's fine.
I genuinely don't believe they would. I'm so happy the European Court was like, yeah, this is totally unacceptable. This isn't legitimate political speech. This isn't a freedom of expression issue. This is, you know, goes directly against our core values. And I think that's important.
Yes, I think that's a really important point. So all of these courts are, even if they're not saying it out loud, they are making some judgments about the core values of the country they're in or the region they're in, and determining whether this speech fits in some way or other with those values. Okay, I have another case for you. This time we're going to Sweden. Supreme Court in Sweden found the conviction of applicants for the distribution of leaflets disseminated homophobic propaganda was not a violation of their right to free expression. So backing up, four Swedish citizens went to a secondary school and distributed leaflets containing statements against homosexuality. So these leaflets contained the following statements. I'm going to give them to you straight up this time. These are quotes from the leaflets, not what I'm saying. In the course of a few decades, society has swung from rejection of homosexuality and other sexual deviances to embracing this deviant sexual proclivity. Your anti-Swedish teachers know very well that homosexuality has a morally destructive effect on the substance of society and will willingly try to put it forward as something normal and good. Tell them that HIV and AIDS appeared early with the homosexuals and that their promiscuous lifestyle was one of the main reasons for this modern-day plague gaining a foothold. Tell them that homosexuality lobby organizations are also trying to play down pedophilia and ask if this sexual deviation should be legalized, end quote. Obviously, this is translated. So the original Swedish said something else. The court translated it to English as I've just read to you. Applicants were charged with agitation against a national or ethnic group and were sentenced to fines and imprisonment. The Swedish Supreme Court changed the charges to just fines and suspended sentences. And then they appealed to the European Court. So, Steve, were the Swedish citizens' rights violated?
I hope not. I mean, that was surely demonizing homosexuals. But I mean, the problem is there were some little Weasley words, at least in the English version, because they say things like, you know, one of the main causes for this modern day plague. So they're not, you know, as explicitly blaming homosexuals as the previous guy was blaming all Muslims for the attack on the Twin Towers. So, you know, again, that weaselly, wordy stuff perhaps gives them some legitimate foothold with the European court. And of course, the HIV and HIV/AIDS epidemic did largely start in the homosexual community, although, you know, that they were not the reason that it spread into the heterosexual community or through the heterosexual community. So it's much more complicated than that. But, you know, they could make the argument that they're giving talking points to students to ask complicated questions of teachers who are pushing this as being a legitimate, you know, choice. I think it's hateful towards people who are homosexuals, obviously, and I hope that the European court didn't overturn this verdict, but I don't know.
Yeah, I think your point there is really important. So rather than, a poster that sort of, you know, doesn't provide any real information and doesn't attempt to, not that this is real information, but you can see that there's an attempt here to formulate an argument. And probably these four people believed this. It's tough because, you know, you can believe whatever you want, but when you start talking about it and saying things that are hurtful to other people, that becomes something different. I think it's also important to remember that this was happening at a school. So I don't know if that makes it better or worse. I guess it depends on how you think about it. On the one hand, you know, you have impressionable young people who are receiving this information. On the other hand, you can say, well, maybe they really were trying to contribute to the conversation or to start a conversation. And from a U.S. perspective, we might say something like, well, actually, this was an opportunity. And I could see this happening at, you know, one of the liberal state schools where we used to live, and parents saying, this is a great opportunity to talk about how wrong this is and how untrue it is, and to arm our children with better information. And maybe we wouldn't have had these conversations otherwise, but we're having them now. Again, I'm aware that that's very American perspective to this whole thing. But I am sorry to tell you, Steve, that the European Court of Human Rights decision in this case was unanimous and found that although this conviction did infringe on the applicant's rights, it was justified and necessary. Because in a democratic society, you have to restrict some of these things. And there was a legitimate aim here. And the legitimate aim was to protect the reputation and rights of others. So they found that in this case, the conviction was proportionate to the aim pursued. Now, it's not clear to me if the Supreme Court in Sweden had not cut out the sentence, whether the result would have been the same. It may have been that the court, if there was an actual prison sentence involved, the court may have said this isn't proportional. And so I think they were sort of drawing a line here to say this is okay, but, you know, let's not push it much further.
Yeah. No, I mean, and I think that seems like a very reasonable decision. I mean, I quite like the logic inside that, because obviously, you know, it is offensive and not true to blame homosexuals for these things. So the spread of HIV and AIDS. So, nor is it deviant or unnatural. And that, I think, I like that judgment. Yay, go Europe.
Okay, so how might the U.S. court handle this same issue? Again, I think based on the previous scenarios we looked at, it's pretty clear. I don't know for sure. The court would look at the facts carefully, including how the restriction is worded, and that's really important. But again, I have a really hard time imagining the court allowing this type of speech to be restricted, even if it were more targeted, even if it were more offensive. So, you know, if we take the wording here, not that it's not offensive enough, just to be clear, that's not what I'm saying. But I'm saying that, you know, if we take it and we even add a layer, it's hard to imagine that. Now, sometimes the court will say that there are restrictions that are allowed if it's disruptive, for example, and, you know, will allow schools to put some restrictions in place. But handing leaflets outside of the school gates, I think, is, you know, the U.S. court is going to struggle to find a problem with that.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. Based on everything we've heard so far, seems very unlikely.
Okay. And one more case for you. We've talked about Germany quite a bit. So let's take a look at a case from Germany. So this is a German case, and you know, we've said already the rules in Germany about Holocaust denial in particular are really unique. So just keep that in mind as we go through this fact pattern. In this case, applicants sent a letter to a well-known historian professor who had published an article regarding the culpability of the Nazi Party and Hitler. So this letter that was sent to the professor said that the professor's statements were false and historically unsustainable. So the letter further argued that there's no indication in party programs of the National Socialist German Workers' Party that they and Hitler, quote, intended to murder Jews. Okay. So just to be really clear, this professor had written an article that appeared in a newspaper, and the applicant in this case had written a private letter to this professor disagreeing with what the professor had published. The professor in turn submitted the letter to the police, and the applicant was convicted of disparaging the dignity of the deceased and sentenced to 3 months imprisonment. So, Steve, should the applicant's letter be protected free expression?
Oh, this is the tricky one, because as you said, there are very specific rules in Germany about the Holocaust in particular and the Nazi Party. So, I mean, if there is a statute in Germany that involves disparaging the dignity of the deceased to protect, you know, the Holocaust victims and to prevent Holocaust denial, then no, it shouldn't be protected free speech. And I don't think the EU should interfere in that particular rule given history. But I don't think that you would get a... I don't think that that would apply across the rest of Europe. I don't think that would be consistent with most European countries, right? So it's a bit difficult.
Okay, so I'm going to challenge you a little bit here to think about at what point would it be too much? So let's say there's a German law that allows you to prosecute someone for a private text message. So let's say I send you a private text message, not even asserting that I don't believe something, but asking a question and saying, you know, this doesn't really make sense to me. What do you think? And let's say that there's a German law that allows me to be prosecuted for that. So if you go to the police and show, even that I was poking around this question, that I can be sent to prison.
No, obviously, in that case, that should not be something that you should go to prison for. And I mean, you know, I guess you're getting at the point that this guy sent him a private letter. It wasn't like he published 6-foot-high billboards calling him a liar because the Holocaust never happened and the Nazis weren't into the industrial slaughter of the Jews, which they manifestly were. So, yes, that would be a big difference. And I mean, private communications, I think, are different. People, a conversation between two people, going back to one of the points I made earlier, is a bit different than, you know, a hate group or individual with a, you know, has a particular hate for someone making pointless statements like "thank God for dead soldiers." There's no argument to be made there that he's making a point. In this case, I guess if he had a legitimately held view and was asking this guy why he was lying about it, there are probably better ways of dealing with it than going to the police. But what did the European court say? Or are you going to challenge me some more?
I mean, I challenge you every day. That's part of what's so fun about my job. No, and it really wasn't. It's really not to catch you out. It's really hard, I think, to know where to draw that line. I think especially when you're looking at a really complicated, not just fact pattern, but historical background. And that was sort of the, you know, the situation with the suburb in the U.S. fact pattern, too, with the neo-Nazi march. It's sort of, you have to look at all of these things and think about the historical context and figure it out, and also think about how to balance that against protecting some of these rights, because once they're gone, they're gone. And actually, one of the things, you know, we fought against in a lot of our wars is protecting these rights, and so they're important. In this case, the court noted that the applicant denied neither the Holocaust as such nor the existence of gas chambers. That seemed to be important to them, but said that he denied an equally significant and established circumstance of the Holocaust. And that this was part of the war propaganda historically. So the court found that the public interest in the prevention of crime and disorder due to disparaging statements and requirements of protecting the interests of the victims outweigh the applicant's freedom to impart these views. So the interference with his rights was necessary, and the conviction was allowed to stand. Now,
even though it was a private communication. Wow.
Even though it was a private communication. So, you know, how might the U.S. court handle, how might the United States Supreme Court handle the same issue? Again, it's very difficult to imagine the Supreme Court restricting this type of speech, especially in a private letter. Of course, they would look at all the surrounding circumstances and consider the context. But even if we change a number of these facts to be more in favor of an intervention, I have a really hard time imagining a fact pattern where the court would agree that this sort of speech can be limited in any circumstance that resembles this one. And I think this is a great opportunity to sort of circle back to what we talked about last time. So there's a lot of talk right now about anti-Semitism on U.S. college campuses and how we grapple with that and how we provide, you know, the protection that students need and deserve, both in terms of their physical safety and their ability to live their lives without being intimidated or whatever it is, and also the right to free expression, free speech. And a lot of people feel that the universities have not been protective enough of students. And I don't mean their free speech. I mean, they've not been restrictive enough in the speech that they're allowing. But what I really want to point out is, you know, there is sort of a spectrum of what we allow. And in the U.S., we do tend to be really permissive in terms of what we allow, especially when it's hate speech. You can go all the way to the other side and look at Germany. But I think for most Americans, and even you reading this, Steve, who, you know, you're sort of in the middle in a lot of ways, it is a really strange sort of thing to think that this private communication is enough to have somebody put in prison.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine that being a popular decision in Canada, and I can't imagine them doing it in the US at all. And I think you're right. You know, I mean, obviously, Jewish students or any you know, minority group that's being harassed on campuses do deserve and should be protected by the campus authorities and the campus police and so on and so forth. But it is freedom of expression and freedom of speech on college campuses are important. They've been important sites of legitimate civil disobedience and civil protest, which have changed the law in the past, and I sincerely hope that they will be again. They're in school. These kids are in school to learn and do better, and you don't learn by stopping them, but by not having conversations, by not talking about difficult issues. If the situation in the Middle East was simple, we would have solved it by now. It's not like very smart people haven't tried lots of times. It's complicated, and it's also complicated for them to understand.
Yes, and I think to your point earlier, there is a difference between having a conversation and trying to have this back and forth and just one person shouting into the void. So like Westboro, for example. But, you know, if we allow that, and remember that was an 8-1 decision from our Supreme Court. If we allow that and then say on university campuses, students can't protest, that doesn't match up. And so what we're talking about then is potentially a major shift in our position on hate speech, which I'm okay with. I'm actually really on board with a step towards the European approach, because I actually don't think hate speech deserves the same kind of protection that other types of speech do. But if that's what you're arguing, I think you have to be really clear about the fact that is what you're arguing. And you're saying that you want to take a step closer to the way it's done in Europe. And I think a lot of people haven't yet made that connection in their own minds.
Yeah. And I mean, we started, you know, talking about hate speech on campuses and the, you know, the vilification of the Harvard president, as well as the others who, the university presidents, for their failure to do it. But no congressman is suggesting that we should be moving towards a European model for managing hate speech in the US. That, you know, that was not what they were saying at all. They wanted speech they didn't like restricted. And conversely, of course, speech they do like should be allowed regardless and without any hindrance. And that's that's not the foundation of a thriving democracy. The founding fathers knew that, and that's why it's the First Amendment, isn't it? To protect and set up the US for success, free speech was important.
No, absolutely right. And we've been going on for nearly an hour, and I think we could probably go on for another hour after this. But I think that's probably a good place to wrap up. Next episode, we'll start our look at campaign finance in the United States and discuss how social media has changed or hasn't changed how political campaigns are run and regulated. Spoiler, it has very much changed the way these things are done. In the meantime, we'll post a transcript of this episode with references on our website.
Until next time, I'm Stephen Jones.
And I'm Taryn Ward.
Thank you for joining us for Breaking the Feed, social media beyond the headlines.